Welcome to episode 20 of our podcast series. This episode features material from our May 2024 print edition of the Residential Aged Care Communique. I'm Joseph Ibrahim, the editor. This podcast episode presents two clinical cases that provide contrasting narratives. The first case examines the use of terminal sedation in a person with unrelenting distress due to frontotemporal dementia. The second case describes a person who was the subject of an opioid medication error just before dying from metastatic cancer. Our expert commentary in this podcast addresses frontotemporal dementia and terminal sedation. We once again present the reflections of our senior nurses, which follows the expert commentary. Our narrator is Ashley Redmond, a practicing registered nurse and actor. Let's now listen to the editorial.
Table of contents. Editorial. Case 1. Live and let die. Case 2. An inconsequential error. Expert commentary. Frontotemporal dementia and terminal sedation. Reflections of senior nurses. Editorial. By Professor Joseph E. Ibrahim. This residential aged care communique, May 2024 edition, examines particularly challenging aspects of palliative care for persons with dementia, for those who have lost decision-making capacity, and terminal sedation. We present two clinical cases that provide contrasting narratives. The first case examines the use of terminal sedation in a person with unrelenting distress due to frontotemporal dementia. The second case describes a person who was a subject of an opioid medication error just before dying from metastatic cancer. In both cases, each received medication that causes sedation. However, the indication for prescribing and whether this contributed to the death differed. Superficially, there appears to be little distinction between the two cases, as the actions taken are almost identical. Each presents a person in distress. Consultation with family, referral to advanced care plan, the prescription and administration of medication that causes sedation, followed by death. Closer examination of each case demonstrates differences that are not subtle. Our expert commentary is written by Dr. Kylie Staggard and Dr. Aaron Buck-Ong Wong, drawing on their combined extensive experiences in geriatric medicine and palliative care medicine. We are fortunate to once again have Dr. Hung Nguyen write the main case precis in a clear and thoughtful manner.
Let's now listen to a description of our first case report titled Live and Let Die, The Doctrine of Double Effect.
Case 1. Live and Let Die, The Doctrine of Double Effect. The case precis author is Dr. Hung Nguyen. Clinical summary. JW was a 58-year-old mother of five with epilepsy since childhood. In 2009, she was hospitalized for continuous and uncontrolled epileptic seizures, resulting in brain injury with progressive psychological and behavioral changes. JW was subsequently diagnosed with frontotemporal dementia, FTD, with episodes of aggression, wandering, calling out, and distress, and required significant assistance with activities of daily living. In 2011, she entered residential aged care with a public trustee appointed as administrator of her estate. At this point, JW displayed some agitation to new surrounds and people, however, did not accept care and medications. In late 2013, significant deterioration in her behaviours prompted a referral to a geriatrician for assessment and management. Her behaviours at this time were marred by increasing agitation, confusion, anxiety, and verbal and physical aggression. In January 2014, JW was transferred to a secure nursing home under the orders of an appointed public guardian. Her condition continued to worsen, and in August she was subsequently transferred to a specialised facility for the assessment and treatment of elderly persons with mental illness and dementia, operated by statewide mental health services. During this admission, the treating team offered treatments for potential reversible causes and attempted to manage her symptoms by pharmacological and non-pharmacological means, albeit without success. JW also experienced a significant functional decline, including her swallow, and became more dependent. The treating geriatrician described JW's state of distress as evidenced by screaming, physical resistance, rejecting personal care and nutrition, lashing out, aggression with staff in harm to herself, thus sustaining injuries which added to her suffering, and that she required up to 3 nurses to administer basic care, at risk to herself and staff involved due to highly combative and aggressive responses. Her deterioration and severe, distressing behavioural and psychiatric symptoms were attributed to her FTD. JW was assessed as not having the capacity to make decisions and identified by the treating medical team as being in the pre-terminal stage of her disease. Her goals of care was assessed as being in Category C for non-burdensome, non-invasive medical care and palliative management and support. Consultation with a palliative care specialist was undertaken given her persistent and significantly distressing symptoms and in line with her goals of care. The recommendation was for heavy sedation to alleviate her severe, constant and unrelenting distress and promote comfort and dignity, with the understanding that JW would continue to deteriorate and die. This was discussed with JW's 2 sons, daughter, and carer during a multidisciplinary team meeting with the palliative care specialist, geriatric team, and social worker in attendance on September 3. The geriatrician met again with the family on the same day and answered their questions before proceeding with the sedation. On September 4, levomepromazine was commenced at a low initiation dose and other medications were rationalised, taking into account her swallowing safety. JW remained distressed and physically aggressive in the following days, prompting a change to a syringe driver of morphine, midazolam, and levomepromazine on September 8 after consultation with family. On September 11, a second syringe driver with phenobarbitone was commenced to assist with seizures and agitation management. From September 14, JW was in medication-induced sedation, comfortable and did not rouse to hygiene nor accept fluids or nutrition. JW died on September 18. Pathology. The autopsy revealed brain changes consistent with FTD without evidence of vascular dementia. There was consolidation of the lungs that was likely a consequence of aspiration pneumonia. Toxicology revealed therapeutic levels of phenobarbitone, olanzapine, morphine, citalopram, and midazolam. The cause of death was determined to be due to aspiration pneumonia following palliative treatment for FTD. Investigation. The treating physician contacted the coroner's office to discuss JW's case in the days leading up to her death. This death was reported to the coroner due to its unnatural nature and that it occurred while she was in care. Concerns were also expressed by some family members regarding the process of palliative sedation leading to JW's death, which brought into question their understanding of the process. The coroner's investigation was centred on 1. Whether JW was a person held in care and her death reportable. 2. Whether consultation with the family regarding the decision to palliate JW was adequate. 3. Whether the decision to palliate JW was in accordance with current, appropriate and ethical practice. The inquest called upon testimonies from JW's son, the nurse in charge of the facility, the geriatrician and palliative care consultants. Expert opinions were sought from an independent specialist in palliative care and the examining forensic pathologist. Coroner's findings. 1. Reportable death. A person held in care is defined in the Act as a person detained or liable to be detained in an approved hospital within the meaning of the Mental Health Act 2013, or in a secure mental health unit, or another place while in the custody if the controlling authority of a secure mental unit within the meaning of that Act. JW had FTD, not a mental illness, under the Mental Health Act, and was not detained or liable to be detained under the provisions of the Act. Therefore, JW was not a person held in care, and her death was not reportable, nor was an inquest mandatory. The jurisdiction of the coroner to investigate and hold an inquest was on the grounds that the death may have been categorised as unnatural and may have been reportable. 2. Family consultation. JW lacked the capacity to make medical decisions due to the severity of her FTD. She did not have an advance care directive to guide medical care. The guardianship order in place in the months leading up to her death gave the public guardian power over where JW was to live, but not her medical decisions. The coroner conceded that a guardian for medical decisions would have been beneficial, but may not have been deemed necessary if there was a consensus among family members and between the family and the medical team. Evidence obtained from 3 specialists reviewing medical records showed that communication and measures to engage the family in this treatment process were high quality and consistent. The coroner was satisfied that JW's son understood that treatment would lead to her imminent death. However, the coroner offered that her family may have been under a great deal of pressure to make difficult decisions that they may not have felt equipped to do. 3. Palliative sedation. Sedation was a contributing factor in the death of JW by aspiration pneumonia. The doctrine of double effect. Morally wrong if caused intentionally, but permissible if foreseen but unintended, is a defence under common law in England. In several jurisdictions in Australia and internationally, there are legislative protections for medical practitioners when legitimately providing care and symptom management that may also contribute to death. In Tasmania, there is no legislation provision to this effect. Terminal sedation, as a treatment in cases of severe, distressing agitation and torment, is both understood in palliative care practice and supported in studies in the scientific literature. In JW's case, the testimony from the independent expert in palliative care supported the treatment decision of sedation, as her distress was unable to be relieved by any other means, and taking into account the advanced nature of her underlying dementia. The coroner found that the decision to provide palliative care in the form of terminal sedation to JW was in line with current ethical medical practice. The coroner found that terminal sedation was a contributing factor in the death of JW by aspiration pneumonia. The coroner concluded that the practitioners concerned provided appropriate care and treatment in accordance with ethical principles. Author's comments. This case involves the inference of distress that could not be assuaged by any other means, but for the prescription of heavy sedation, which can foreseeably, even if unintended, hasten death. It highlights the complexity and dynamic nature of shared decision-making on behalf of a person who has lost decision-making capacity. Though the doctrine of double effect and terminal sedation is recognised in the medical literature, the ethical and moral acceptability of such actions is weighty for all involved.
Let's now listen to a description of our second case report titled An Inconsequential Error.
Case 2. An Inconsequential Error. The case precy author is Professor Joseph Ibrahim. Clinical summary. Mr. BB was an 80-year-old man living at home with his family. He had a complex past medical history. 14 years earlier, he had a right upper lobe lung cancer of intermediate histology, treated with right upper lobectomy. 1 year later, the lung cancer recurred and was treated with chemotherapy. 12 years later, he was diagnosed with a brain metastasis in the left parietal lobe, which was surgically removed, followed by 5 sessions of radiation therapy to the brain. Other comorbidities included diabetes mellitus, ischemic heart disease, and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. A home palliative care nurse practitioner saw Mr. BB in late February, who noted recent significant weight loss, poor control of the pain in his lower back, presence of hallucinations, very drowsy, stops mid-sentence and closing his eyes. The medication regimen was modified to introduce hydromorphone, prescribed at 1 milligram every 3 hours as needed. 1 week later, the palliative care nurse practitioner spoke with the family, explaining that Mr. BB was deteriorating, becoming weaker and with ongoing pain. A do not resuscitate status was confirmed with the family. The nurse practitioner noted that no one had advised the family directly of the prognosis, and the family asked, "If it is not the medication causing the deterioration, how long are we looking at?" The nurse explained that if his worsening condition was not related to the medication, and assuming the disease was causing the changes, then he likely had days to weeks. Mr. BB was admitted to a local hospital that same day in the evening in an attempt to improve the management of his intractable lower back pain. The primary cancer was a poorly differentiated squamous cell carcinoma of the left lung, with metastases to the spleen, adrenals, and lungs. A change in the opioid medication regimen resulted in a relatively rapid improvement in pain control, but he was more sedated. The pharmacy staff detected a medication error, which resulted in 3 milligrams of hydromorphone controlled release instead of regular acting being administered on 3 occasions at night. The error was reported to medical and nursing staff, who disclosed this to Mr. BB's partner. Over the next 2 days, he had increased respiratory distress. A chest X-ray revealed chest congestion and a possible infiltrate in left lower lobe. His respiratory status stabilized following diuresis, and in accordance with his wishes, he was discharged home with oxygen for comfort and subcutaneous hydromorphone infusion. He died the following day at home. Pathology. An autopsy was not conducted. A post-mortem blood sample was measured and found narcotic levels to be in the therapeutic range. The cause of death was metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. Investigation. An investigation was conducted to address the medication error and his family's concerns that this may have hastened death. The Geriatric and Long-Term Care Review Committee, the committee, examined the hospital medical records and the investigating coroner statement. Findings and recommendations. The committee determined the purpose of the hospitalization was to A. improve pain control, B. determine if any of Mr. BB's confusion and sedation was due to the medication, oxycodone. The respiratory decompensation due to metastatic lung cancer, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, fluid overload, muscle weakness, and medication, opioids and diazepam, was stabilized. Better pain control was achieved with some increased sedation, with hydromorphone subcutaneous at 0.3 mg per hour, with breakthrough 0.5 mg subcutaneous every 30 minutes. The committee considered that the medication error did not contribute to death for 2 reasons. First, the passage of time, 3 days, between the administration of the controlled-release opioid and his death was long. Second, the dose of hydromorphone delivered via subcutaneous infusion required to achieve comfort care, and an improvement in his respiratory status was higher than the doses of oral hydromorphone administered earlier in his hospital stay. The committee recommended hospitals develop a standard approach to documenting medication errors in the clinical record, including a clear description of the error, communication of the error to the patient or substitute decision maker, clinical consequences of the error, and steps taken if required to address any clinical consequences of the error.
Let's now listen to our expert commentary titled Frontotemporal Dementia and Terminal Sedation.
Expert commentary. Frontotemporal Dementia and Terminal Sedation. Dr. Kylie Staggard, geriatrician, Royal Melbourne Hospital. And Dr. Aaron Buck-Ong Wong, geriatrician and palliative medicine physician with the Royal Melbourne Hospital, Austin Health, Epworth Healthcare, and Melbourne Private Hospital. Frontotemporal dementia causes progressive, irreversible damage to the frontal and or temporal lobes of the brain and can affect behaviour, personality, speech and movement, with later memory impairment. It typically presents before the age of 65 years, and unfortunately, there are currently no treatment options available to cure or to slow disease progression. The average life expectancy is estimated to be around 6 to 11 years post-onset of symptoms. JW died 5 years after her diagnosis. Most individuals with dementia experience behavioral and psychological symptoms of dementia, BPSD, as their disease progresses. Examples of BPSD include agitation, hallucinations, delusions, altered sleep-wake cycle, apathy, depressive behaviour, aberrant motor behaviour, dysphoria, anxiety, irritability, and changes in eating patterns. JW had marked BPSD, including aggression towards staff and family and frequent screaming, culminating in what was described as constant distress. Moderate to severe BPSD in nursing home residents has been associated with an increased risk of death. Severe BPSD can cause considerable suffering for individuals with dementia, family distress, and challenges for care staff in residential aged care facilities, particularly where staffing ratios and access to timely specialist support can be limited outside of business hours and in regional remote areas. Carers and clinicians are encouraged to focus on the individual needs and symptoms of the person living with dementia. The management of BPSD involves excluding any potentially reversible and treatable factors, for example, pain, infection, constipation, urinary retention, medication side effects, and then focusing on non-pharmacological interventions such as diversional activity, calming environment, massage, and music. Utilizing a behavior management plan can help identify triggers and unmet needs and monitor the effect of any interventions, including the cautious use of psychotropic medications where indicated. The advanced stages of dementia are marked by a profound level of dependency on others to meet basic needs, progressive immobility, loss of appetite and dysphagia, with consequent risk of sudden deterioration due to aspiration. We often see weight loss, recurrent delirium, infections, falls, and impairment of an individual's ability to communicate and express needs. Healthcare professionals and family carers may have difficulty recognizing when people with dementia are approaching the end of life. The advanced stage of dementia may last for months and sometimes years, with an unpredictable course, which impacts the ability to recognize when the person is dying. Prognostication can be difficult even for experienced clinicians. It is not always possible to distinguish between BPSD, terminal restlessness, and severe agitated delirium in the dying phase. The unifying goal of treatment is optimizing symptom control. There is usually something we can do to alleviate symptoms, but unfortunately, there are times when none of the standard interventions seem to help. These persistent symptoms can be viewed as refractory. In our experience, severe refractory symptoms and associated suffering can have a profound impact on the individual, family, care staff, and co-residents in aged care homes. What do we do when reversible factors have been excluded and an exhaustive trial of traditional interventions has not been helpful in reducing an individual's ongoing distress in the last days or weeks of life? Palliative sedation therapy is the intentional use of proportionate sedation to relieve a patient suffering from uncontrolled and refractory symptoms, such as dyspnea, agitation, nausea, vomiting, pain, and terminal restlessness. Palliative sedation can be considered as a last resort intervention and generally has the following key elements. 1. It is reserved for the treatment of refractory symptoms, which are irreversible and cause intolerable suffering. 2. The multidisciplinary consensus is that all other options for treatment have been explored. 3. It is only considered in patients with advanced progressive and terminal illness who are approaching death, usually within the last 2 weeks of life. 4. It uses pharmacological agents to reduce consciousness with the primary intent of controlling symptoms, not to hasten death, although this may be a secondary consequence. And 5. Palliative sedation is distinct from voluntary assisted dying by its intent and action. Since March 2020, several Australian state-based guidance documents exist for the use of palliative sedation. However, to the best of our knowledge, Australia does not currently have a national consensus document on the use of palliative sedation therapy. The statewide guidelines generally recommend that palliative sedation should only be provided under the guidance and support of specialist palliative care services. The recent European Association for Palliative Care framework suggests that unless an emergency, light sedation at the end of life should generally be attempted first, with introduction of deeper sedation as required. Palliative sedation results in complete physical dependency, so it is important that it is carried out in an appropriate environment and adequate care support. The medications utilized for JW are currently listed in our local guidelines for the management of agitated dying. The patient or their surrogate medical treatment decision maker must agree to palliative sedation. As palliative sedation is regarded as a medical procedure treatment, consent should be obtained and documented accordingly. Specific consent issues should be considered in conjunction with relevant policy and state legislation, as these may vary. Where the person lacks the capacity to consent, an advance care directive, ACD, or prior discussion may help guide this process. In months leading up to her death, JW was unable to communicate with her care providers meaningfully, and she had not completed an ACD, so her wishes and values were not known. A written expression of her wishes may well have eased some of the difficulty and burden of responsibility felt by her children. Advanced care planning conversations should occur as soon as possible after a diagnosis of dementia. This can ensure a person's family are aware of their values and preferences for future care, and where possible, an appropriate future substitute decision maker can be identified. Alternatively, if a person already lacks the capacity to complete a formal ACD, Advanced Care Planning Australia has developed a form that a person's recognised substitute decision maker can complete to help guide future treatment goals. Palliative sedation, although ethically complex and sometimes considered controversial, is an accepted therapy option available as part of specialist palliative care in Australia. It is more commonly used for physical symptoms than for severe and intolerable psychological symptoms. In this context, it is essential that multidisciplinary support, education, and guidance are available. The overall goals of care should be clear. Family and care staff should have multiple and ongoing opportunities to ask questions and voice any concerns with the process. The treating team needs to monitor for psychological, moral, and spiritual distress. It is important to debrief staff and actively support carers and family before and after bereavement. It is unclear whether JW's family accepted an offer of counselling and pastoral care support. In summary, the findings of this coronial inquest affirmed the importance of a clear and thorough attempt to find any reversible causes of BPSD. Use of behavioral support strategies as first line. Trials of pharmacological interventions with active monitoring of efficacy and adverse effects in improving symptoms and distress. Seeking timely and carefully considered second opinions and specialist advice. Formal multidisciplinary family meetings with conveying of information in appropriate terminology. Open and honest discussions about illness severity, prognosis, and the aims and likely consequences of palliative sedation in order to guide shared decision-making. Regular updates on progress and appropriate support after initiating sedation. Thorough documentation of the clinical decision-making process and communication details with care providers and family. A national consensus approach outlining principles for the safe and effective use of palliative sedation therapy is needed to help guide clinicians and staff involved in caring for people with life-limiting diseases across various settings.
Let's now listen to the reflections of senior nurses.
Reflections of senior nurses. These are clinically interesting and often confronting situations. To manage these situations well as a team, you want to work in an environment where staff feel safe to question aspects of care and are willing to speak up when unsure, unclear, or have doubts. A safe space with trust within the clinical team is essential to a good safety culture. The manager or clinical leader needs to be aware of what is happening in their area and observe how everyone responds to the complex situation. I have seen these types of cases pop up over time, and I always made sure I listened to everyone and that the whole team understood and was comfortable with the care that was being given. This can be nurses, doctors, junior doctors, or allied health staff. To provide optimal care for the resident and their family, detailed and accurate documentation is required, especially for staff who will be on duty after hours. The after-hours staff may have their own questions about the situation and may also need to respond to questions from the family. Reading a summary of discussions and the decisions that have been agreed to and those that have yet to be decided with the family and resident helps. There were times when staff questioned things, and this was an opportunity to get the nurses and medical staff together, acknowledge this space, and talk it through together to ensure a clear understanding of the decisions being made and why. The compassion for this resident and her children was evident throughout, and the staff involved should be acknowledged, as caring for someone experiencing this degree of distress is physically and emotionally exhausting. It takes time, skill, and a willingness to get to know someone we provide care for. And without that understanding, our care cannot be considered optimal. The crux of my concern is how difficult it is, given the resident's complex diagnoses and resulting distress, to know if all appropriate strategies have been trialled. For example, perhaps the symptoms the resident experienced could have been due to past trauma and may have benefited from trauma-informed care. It is not easy to know.
Thank you for listening to this podcast episode. Remember, the online print versions are available at our website, which also includes a list of the recommended resources and references. We also have an extensive catalogue of previous editions of the Residential Aged Care Communique, along with our sister publications. There is also a library of recorded webinars that examine clinical dilemmas and mental health on our website. I'm Joseph Ibrahim. Thanks for listening.